Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, Dell, Acer, and Asus announced new laptops, and we want so bad to beat on the new ruggedized Dell tablet, a new best bargain CPU cooler, and a mouse that might last forever. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 430, recorded August 31st, 2017. In order of magnitude better.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter promo code TWITCH to save 20% off any order.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most informative, most engaging, most delightful, and yes, ladies and gentlemen, most useful news about PC hardware, Mac hardware, mobile internet consoles, and the Internet of Stuff. This is a family show, so we can't call it the Internet of Other Things. Joining me now, Mr. Family himself, Ryan Shrout. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks for finding a way, connecting in, and finding a way to be on the show this week with us.
Well, you know, someone has to set an example to you and your total lack of connectivity when traveling. My video is probably a little fuzzy. I'm down at San Diego at TourCon, so if the door gets kicked open, it's because they think I'm a hacker. Exciting news, right? We talked about the 8th generation Core Intel processors coming out. We talked about them not exactly being 8th generation if you're in terms of architecture. That Intel says if you make the processors, you can name them whatever delete expletive generation they want to because they are making the processors and they claim they're 40% faster, which if you're using multi-threaded devices should be the truth, not that we can test it until they ship. So bringing everybody up to speed on 8th core processors, let's talk about some of the announcements. One of our favorites, quad-core XPS 13, which is going to be available with all of the other 8th generation devices in September of this year. And essentially, it's the ever so delightful quad-core XPS 13 that I've been carrying for the last year, but with a quad-core 8th gen Copy Lake processor, which means things I like to do like running video rendering tools will suddenly be significantly faster because the number of threads and cores available to them on the processor will be doubled. I like this. I'm also very curious to see what the battery life impact is like, although we are assured battery life will not go down.
Yeah, if you go to their website, they still quote the same 22 hours of battery life for the 1080p model and 12 hours for the QHD Plus model, which, first of all, I didn't realize there was that huge of a gap between the two different models of XPS 13. That's like a dramatic difference. Even if we know we're never actually going to see 22 hours out of either one of them, the relative difference between them is substantial. Those 22 and 12 numbers match the performance listed of the dual core Kaby Lake 7th gen Dell XPS 13 machines. So in theory, based on Dell's metrics, there would be no degradation in performance degradation in battery life when doing the normal battery life tests, right? If you're going to utilize those threads and cores more heavily, you know, depending on your workload, you may see a decrease there, but doesn't look like there's any other changes. Like, this is very simply a processor swap. The design is the same. Looks like the battery is the same. Screen resolution options are the same. So nothing, no big changes there. Although, you know, what I'm really curious about is what the pricing may do with this, right? So Intel is, you know, they show pricing on their ARC website, which is kind of their specification website. And the pricing on these solutions is only like $20 more than the dual core parts. That being said, the way Intel is working with OEMs like Dell, HP, Lenovo, these giant entities, what they're probably trying to do is get some of their flagship products out, like the XPS 13, XPS 15 from Dell, the Spectre from HP, the Lenovo X1 series. They want to get those quad core parts in there like quickly and affordably. So it wouldn't surprise me if you know, you kind of only see these quad-core derivatives and these kind of flagship components, and you don't, like, we're not going to see a universal replacement of Kaby Lake dual-core Core i7, Core i5s with quad-core Kaby Lake Refresh Core i7s and Core i5s. That'd be my guess, at least.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make sense in a lot of the price performance categories, and most of the people, especially at the low end, aren't going to see a whole huge difference, I think, in their everyday use. Not to drift off, but there. Another one that came out from Dell this week, because we have some other, you know, we'll talk about this one in a minute or two. We should talk about IFA 2017. Acer announced the passively cooled Switch 7 Black Edition.
Mm-hmm.
And
so this also uses the quad core variants. It's less a clamshell notebook and more like a Surface design, where it's got a kickstand and it's kind of got the fold up keyboard behind it. The kickstand's a little bit more interesting, and then it has like a hands free engage method where you just kind of you push down on the bottom of the tablet, and it pops open the kickstand behind it. So in theory, you could open it up with one hand. It's a little bit less cumbersome. The fingerprint reader is actually in the bezel of the tablet itself. So you don't have, like, you still get access to it if you don't have the keyboard attached, which is kind of nice. And apparently they have a capability where if the machine is off and you do your fingerprint over the fingerprint sensor on the bezel, it will both turn on the machine and unlock it when it boots up. Like, it is registering the fingerprint acknowledgement and verification even before you get to the Windows login screen, which is just a nice thing, right? It just speeds things up a little bit.
Right.
And it kind of gets the process moving a little bit easier. But the passive cooling on this is even kind of, it almost seems not possible to me, being that you have a 15-watt CPU, and this even has a 20-watt discrete GPU, the MX150, GeForce MX150, which is a very low-end discrete GPU, you know, better than integrated graphics, obviously, but not by a huge amount, right? So this, I think it's got 384 CUDA cores, and I don't know what the clock speeds exactly are, but it's using a dual heat pipe system, which they brand as like liquid cool, or what do they call it? Liquid loop or something like that. It don't feel like it's anything technologically more advanced than we've seen in the past. It is heat pipes. It's larger heat pipes and two of them kind of connecting through. But if it can, the question for me on this is there, say you compare it to that Dell XPS 13 with the same quad core 15 watt parts we just talked about, is this machine going to be able to run at higher clocks for as long as the Dell system? And my guess would be no, there has to be a sacrifice of some kind moving away from active cooling to a completely passive cooling design, and still a very thin, compact tablet system. But now keep in mind, like, the XPS 13 has, you know, the display is separate from the computing hardware. So there's, you know, there's separation of heat a little bit there. And so, but for this Acer, the Switch 7 Black Edition, it's all in one place, right? So there's even more heat kind of in this same physical space than there is on the Dell. So I'm very curious to get my hands on with it and see if we notice any long-term performance deltas between it and stuff like the Dell or HP or whatever else anybody else puts out. It's still a really nice looking device. I've never seen one or used one in person, but impressive design.
They look lovely. I mean, I think the big question is you've nailed it, is you know, if I fire up my favorite video rendering tool, if I, you know, get Handbrake going, and, you know, Handbrake will run all of the cores as hard as it can. And that's, you know, it's a little more practical than using, you know, say a burn-in tool for a processor that maxes out the cores. But you'll very, very quickly find out how fast those cores are running and how fast they can run at a sustained full throttle volume. Is it a typical user scenario? Probably not, but it also amazes me that once you get like 30 or 40 tabs in Chrome, or goodness help you, Firefox, it's always amazing to see how much of your system resources and your CPU go away and your CPU utilization goes up. But that's going to be one of the big questions, and we'll see just exactly how good the design architecture is in terms of pulling away that heat. I mean, the fans on the current processors are not that long, but they are still there. And I'm with you. I'll be very, very curious to see how those work out in the real world. Another product, I really want to test this. The same time I saw, I had to see a preview of the new XPS 13, which looks exactly like an XPS 13, except it's got more cores. Latitude 12 rugged tablet being shown off, and reactions to this online to me have been really, really amusing. I got a link to a Verge article. Dell's new rugged tablet is a clunky giant that runs Windows 7. I love it. Jason Castronakis wrote that one up. One of the other reviews online was like, this is big and slow and stupid, and I hate it. And it's an interesting thing where you've got a purpose-built device that is built a very specific way for a lot of reasons. And obviously, when you look at that thing, it is a big, giant, ruggedized computer.
Yep.
They call it their rugged extreme tablet. It's an 11.6-inch 1080p display. They can run 6th or 7th generation Intel processors. They're not going to be putting 8th gen processors in here. 16 gigs of RAM max, up to a terabyte of solid-state storage. And it can do up to two separate 34-watt-hour batteries. You know, it's running Windows 7, in part because so many of the places that implement devices like these, need the option to be able to compatible with all the existing devices that are out there, all the existing operating system or software out there. And it's fun to look at this because, you know, when people talk about moving to like, oh, we've got to move to a new laptop, and then expensive pain in an office environment. But if you have like, 300 delivery vans or 50 police cars or a bunch of fire trucks or some combination of all of those things, then you have to think about like, if I change form factors, do I have to buy new mounts for everything? Do I have to rewire everything? Do I have to? So, looking at stuff like this, keeping things compatible over time, it's like 2.82 pounds, which sounds outrageous, which is funny to say. For a tablet, it sounds outrageous. That's like 3/4 of a pound lighter than the previous one. Should be fairly more powerful. Costs about $1,900. They have the option of a rugged dock, rugged keyboard cover, a battery charger, just all sorts of, burly stuff. I'll be curious to see what the performance looks like. Hopefully we're going to get one in on Tech Things. I just want to do a video with doing horrible things to it and then holding it up and seeing if it's still running or if it broke yet. Construction looks flawless. It looks like a really, really nice setup. And I like rugged devices because they're fun. Yeah, look, fire.
It's true. I attended a Dell rugged event in Austin last year where we were, not just allowed to, but asked to like take them and throw them. And we were on jet skis on Lake Travis with them and throwing them off the edge of the boat onto the shore, on the rocky shore. And it's impressive what they can do. I took one to on a beach vacation where I let Emmeline like basically bury it in the sand and dig and play around with it. And then I was still able to take it back upstairs and turn it on and use it. They're very unique devices. We actually have a Panasonic Toughbook here in the office too that we're kind of messing around with to do a story around. It's not for general consumers. And if general consumers see it, you're right. The reactions to it are going to be predictably bad. Runs Windows 7, super important for a lot of audiences.
Right. Well, I think it comes with Windows 10. You downgrade to Windows 7, but I think also some people are going to look at it and be like, yeah, that's going to go with my truck. running a 1995 Dodge 2500 with a big old diesel inside of it, it really would blend well with my truck. And although I will say, however many phone screens I've trashed in the last several years of my life, I still haven't managed. I'm not going to say that out loud. I'm going to knock on the wood mirror up here, lest I find myself replacing a laptop screen before I make it out of San Diego. FSP Windell 4 and 6 CPU air cooler. Sebastian wrote this one up. We haven't seen a new air cooler in a while. I see copper tubes. I see black tubes, which aren't nearly as cool as tubes that would change color with your LED lighting, but it does give you an option for inside of the case. 120mm extreme quiet fan enhances cooling performance. High-tech 120mm fin design. I mean, it looks like every other 120 millimeter fan, not to take anything away from FSP. What I love the fact that it's priced at $29.99, and that puts it right in the face of Cooler Master's Hyper 212 Evo. So the question is, can the Evo, or I should say, can the Windale 4 beat the Hyper 212 Evo as the bargain of choice? I should also point out, by the way, the aluminum version with black plating does include a blue LED. It is $44.99, sweet, the Windale 4, which does not include the blue LED and has two fewer heat pipes, is $29.99. What was the performance like on these?
Performance on them was actually pretty good. If you look at the second page, that graph right there, Sebastian did testing, and the Windale 6 obviously performs a little bit better than the Windale 4, bigger, more heat pipes, et cetera, et cetera. And it kind of sandwiches the Hyper 212 Evo, but it's really, really close. Under stress load, you can see, the delta temp of the Cooler Master Hyper 212 Evo was 54.3 degrees Celsius, whereas the Windale 4 was 54.3 and the Windale 6 was 52.9. What's more important, so let's say performance is close, it's within reason. Right. But if you look at the second graph that looks at noise levels, there's a dramatic difference where the FSP Windale 4 and 6 are both quieter under load than the Hyper 212 Evo is at idle state, right?
So wow.
If we had one complaint about the Hyper 212 Evos, it is that they are a little bit louder. Mm-hmm. In most of our environments where we use it, that's not really a big deal. It's not a case or whatever. But if you're comparing $25 to $30 coolers, now you start to look at, okay, performance is pretty much a wash. What are the other differentiating factors? And right. FSP's either, their sleeve-bearing fan or something about the cooler design is allowing it to be more efficient and thus run quieter at essentially the same temperature levels. Looks like we looked at this last night. The Windale 4 is $24.99 on Amazon currently. But the 6 heat pipe version is out of stock. So don't know what the actual pricing is on that. But $24.99 for the Windale 4 is seems like a really good deal for somebody looking for a cooler. A
fantastic deal.
Yeah.
I mean, the Hyper 212
Evo was like $29 now. Yeah.
It's certainly, there's certainly a measurable difference between the Windale 4 and Windale 6. In terms of, idle load and stress tests on a Core i7-7700K. It was interesting to me is that how tiny the deltas are. You're looking at like 1.4 degrees under a full load, degree and a half or so, at a normal load, less than 2 degrees, I think, in almost all deltas. And that's, it's interesting because, oh, wow, so those extra heat pipes and the LED don't do a lot for cooling. But I got to say, not that 47.4 decibels is really loud, but you're looking at, nine decibels quieter for that FSP Windale 4. That's a huge delta in terms of audio levels. And for $25, I think it makes it a fantastic deal, which is probably why it got a PC per gold award, ladies and gentlemen. Yay, more inexpensive heat sinks. That makes me happy. And hey, this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Tracker. There's a ritual to looking for your keys. You check the obvious places, the couch, the kitchen, the pockets. In my house, the kids did a thing once where they stuffed them under the dog bed. I think they didn't want me to go to work, but you get the idea. Things get lost for weird reasons, and you can spend your whole day running around the house, but we got a better idea for you, the Tracker. 8 years ago, Tracker changed everything when they released their first tracking device, and now they've done it again with the new Tracker Pixel. It is really awesome. You never worry about losing your things again. Tracker Pixel is the lightest Bluetooth tracking device on the market. Just place the Tracker Pixel on whatever you tend to lose, your keys, your wallets, your cat. Oh, to be able to find the cat. Think about it. It's small enough to fit on your smallest items without being a drag. And it's easy. When you misplace an item that has a Tracker Pixel attached, you use your smartphone and a 90 decibel alert will howl out to help you find it in seconds. It even has powerful LED lights so you can find your items in the dark. Lose your phone? This is awesome. Just press the button on your Tracker Pixel. You can put one on your key ring and your phone rings even if it's on silent. You can even locate your items if they're miles away, because every tracker user is part of the largest crowd locate network in the world. And as soon as somebody walks by your gear, you'll get an update about where it is. Tracker's 30-day money-back guarantee is awesome, yet truly have nothing to lose. You should go to thetracker.com and enter the promo code TWITCH to save 20% off any order. That's thetracker.com, promo code TWICH, TWITCH, for 20% off. Isn't it time you stop losing things? Oh, my goodness. They're tiny. It's good stuff. AMD Radeon RX Vega 56. Is it an upgrade from the AMD R9 Fury? And the crew at Hard OCP did what the crew at Hard OCP does. They got the benchmarking tools out. This is kind of a follow-up to their full evaluation of the Radeon RX Vega 56 video card, which was a delightful surprise. $399, it takes over for the GTX 1070 as the best card value at $399, which is great because I just bought a 1070. So it's good to know I could have waited and gotten more power. Not that I'm bitter, but their question was taking a look at it, like, you know, do you have a Radeon R9 Fury? So they picked up an Asus Radeon R9 Fury video card, which started at $579. Is that card 2 years old now, Ryan?
Yes. Yeah, I think it is, or very close.
Yeah. You know, the testing. Think somewhere in the neighborhood of 25% in terms of performance boost. That's pretty freaking awesome, you know, if you want to buy a new card.
Right. What's interesting to think about is it's the same number of cores, same number. It's like essentially right. The same compute unit breakdown between these two cards. The difference is really in the clock speed. The boost clock is rated at 1471 megahertz on the Vega 56, and it's rated at 1000 megahertz on the Fury R9 or the R9 Fury. So that's, you know, obviously you can do the math pretty easy on this. That's a 47% difference in clock speed, but we're not getting 47% more performance because the boost clock is, you know, in general, the clock's going to be while you're gaming a little bit below that. So that's interesting to look at. And actually you get a little bit less memory bandwidth as well. You're going from 512 gigabytes per second on the previous generation card to 410 gigabytes per second on the new generation of card, but you're saving, it's at lower power draw and all that type of stuff. So I think 25 to 30% is probably pretty much what we expected going into that. So you'll definitely see a performance improvement with that if you can find one of those cards in stock, I guess. So keep that in mind.
Interesting.
Too.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, it's exciting. I mean, you know, you're looking at, yeah, I guess 35%, 1440 gaming. It's super, super solid on, which is something they didn't feel about the Radeon R9 Fury. So it's good. And it's much cheaper than the R9 Fury was back when it launched, which is a big plus. Oh, my goodness. I'm having a moment where my tab won't open on the browser. You put a story in from Scott. New GPU launch, new attempt to unlock stuff. I'm afraid of what you're trying to unlock here. I am at a hacker conference right now. So,
yeah, nothing that severe. We had talked last week, I think, about the availability issues of Vega, and one of the other complaints is people weren't able to do BIOS mods, which is one of the things that AMD Radeon, you know, a certain segment of those users really, really loved to do. As it turns out, while you can't modify a BIOS because it's signed, you can actually take a Vega 64 BIOS and flash it onto a Vega 56 card, which is not unlocking your shader count, your stream processor count, but is moving you up to higher clock speeds, a higher thermal levels or wattage power draw levels, and thus improving your performance. And based on this was all posted off from a forum post over at Chip Hell, which is a very longstanding, well-known Chinese, you know, computer tech enthusiast forum. the modified Vega 56 with the Vega 64 BIOS scores within 2 or 3% of a Vega 64 just out of the box by just doing that flashing, right? So without any extra tweaking or overclocking, which is actually interesting because in theory, what it's doing is it's actually getting higher clocks than the Vega 64 natively does because it has fewer shader units running and maybe it's getting a little bit more thermal headroom out of it because of that. So it's cool that you can do that because you're basically taking a signed BIOS and putting it, you know, still on a card that is in the same family. So it doesn't appear to be any issues with it. We haven't done any of that in-house yet. Only have one Vega 56. They're really hard to find. I don't really want to try to screw it up or kill it yet. But what this does mean likely is that finding a Radeon RX Vega 56 is going to be even more difficult as people realize that you can do this. You know, spending $100 less for a video card and then just simply flashing it over to run at almost identical performance levels is an easy kind of win-win situation for that.
Right.
But now the race begins to see if you can do any kind of actual BIOS modification to stuff to maybe tweak things a little bit further.
Oh my goodness. It was funny. A story that popped up this morning to kind of turn directions in a different way, but still saving money. There's my segue thread. Nest finally came out with a new thermostat with a new design. The Nest Thermostat E. We haven't had, it's kind of funny. We haven't done a whole lot of Internet of Stuff lately, other than the home automation devices, you know, the Google Home and stuff of that. But, yeah, it was curious for me because this was such a huge player, in part because there were several automated thermostats or intelligent thermostats out at that point. Ecobee had been out for a while at that point, but the Nest built so much on its design and appeal to homeowners and techies. But this is the first new one, really radically new design. I mean, they tweaked the design some, but this is the first kind of rethinking of what it looks like since 2011. So the Nest has been on sale for $249 and will remain on sale, or is now again on sale for $249. But this new model is going to sell for $169. And you notice it's got a kind of a white puck instead of stainless steel, instead of a bright black screen. It's got frosted glass with a relatively not too bright screen on it. Although it's interesting, like it doesn't do the thing. It's not going to do the thing that the more expensive model does, where if it thinks you're across the room, it brightens up the display to show you the temperature. But it's supposed to control something like 85% of the thermal systems in the house, or, you know, HVAC systems in home. The full Nest thermostat still promises like 95%. But the big deal here is the price is going to be $169. I got to say, having been wandering around a bunch at Best Buys lately and looking at the displays, I think they had to finally cut the price because there are so many competitors out there. Especially when I look at some of the latest generation Ecobee stuff, where they seem to be doing a lot more for the money you're spending. But it's kind of curious. I'm also curious to see how Nest does because, you know, one of the things we've read is that internally there were so many battles at Google over home automation and the direction it was going to take, and that Nest would become a less important project. But, you know, Nest is still going. I'm not sure what else to say, but as somebody who's been running a Nest thermometer for probably 5 years,
same here.
And somebody asked me if I would buy it again, and I was like, I'll be honest with you, you know, when the thermometer, the smart thermometer is in the room with my wife and my children and decides nobody's home and turns the heat down to 50 degrees on a 38 degree winter day, I can't say that I'm super impressed, you know, with the intelligent thermometer. But, you know, I've also used a couple other thermometers since then, rotated them in and then rotated them back out. And there's a lot of things it does really, really well. You know, it's curious. I'm curious to see, you know, what comes out next and some of the new developments, because it seems like in the wake of you know, Alexa and Google Home, and of course, Apple's trying very, very hard to make HomePod more relevant. And there's a couple open source efforts that some of the home automation stuff I've been leaning towards, but not ready to, you know, sell my soul for, might actually be practical or at least a little bit more functional. So I don't know. It's going to be curious to launch. The other thing that came up recently while we're talking about the home full of stuff, the internet of stuff, was that Sonos has a new agreement and a new privacy agreement based on their efforts to make Sonos compatible with stuff like Amazon's Echo. And it'll be curious to see what happens with that because Plex decided they were going to start collecting user data, and the outcry was so profound in the forums, they decided they probably weren't going to do that after all. And it looks like Sonos has suggested that if you don't accept their new user privacy policy, that eventually you will start to sort of lose features or lose updates for your system. So I've been traveling a little bit, and I have been on top of that, but you know, it begs the question, you know, if your hardware, your expensive hardware in your house is relying on offsite services to do the thing it does, and you suddenly have to give up more privacy than you want to, you know, what does that mean for you? And in most cases, it means you're SOL. You know, you have a choice between giving up that information to the company that probably wants to resell it, or at the very least aggregate it and use it, or giving up on that hardware. And it's something to think about, especially as you're looking at more expensive stuff, bringing it into your home or adding it to your home systems, is whether or not it's going to share or track information that you don't necessarily want shared or tracked. But something to think about, you know, as you're looking at some of the more expensive purchases, because so much of this stuff is profoundly expensive. Like, I would love to have automated window blinds, you know, but I'm also not going to spend the thousands of dollars it would take to even equip our modestly sized home, you know, our little 1200 square foot, you know, working class cottage. You know, I just wanted to lay that out there. It's something I've been thinking about a lot in the last week. And also, again, being at a hacker conference, realizing once again that the internet of stuff just is one giant joyful attack vector waiting to be exploited. So, sorry, didn't mean to get into the internet minute, or the home automation minute, but I did. So I'm sorry. Coolant CPU 390Ci CPU water block review. This thing is pretty. I mean, I think on some level all water blocks are pretty, but this one for some reason I just find especially delightful. You know, possibly because it looks so extremely well polished on the part that goes down in your processor. You know, really nice configuration. Moore did the write-up on PC Per, but I love the fact that they've got pretty much everything you need, including the tools and the heat sink, the thermal compound. Having had to make a run to a local computer store a few weeks ago to help somebody out because there wasn't thermal compound in the box with the device they were getting. But LGA 211, LGA 1150, 1151, 1155, 1156, 1366, quote, may require BLT CPA SCD12 for fixed motherboard backplates and socket LGA 77. AM4, AM2, AM2 plus, AM3, AM3 plus, FM1, FM2, FM2 plus, which is basically saying it's going to support almost anything you're likely to want to attach this to. How did it fare?
Is Threadripper, so still trying to see what that is. It's not big enough to do a full coverage of Threadripper, but it's, you know, it's fairly close.
You can cover most of Threadripper.
yeah, exactly. It's scary we have to have that conversation, but it's there. So yeah, if you look at the performance page on this, you'll see Mori's results, and it does pretty well, right? They have he tested in two different orientations, you know, rotated 90 degrees, essentially the alt orientation.
Right.
He's giving you delta temperatures, and it's, you know, in line with the previous Coolant CPU 380i, although the build material is a little bit better on the new one, so that gives you an advantage. And then he compares it to three other water blocks that he's looked at recently: the EK Supremacy MX. The Alpha Cool and an XPS RayStorm Pro. And it does very well. It's actually, in OC, it's about the best performer we have seen thus far. Now you're talking about differences of 1 to 3 degrees Celsius, so not huge changes.
Right.
But if you're the kind of guy who is building these and you actually want performance out of it, that's maybe gonna tip your hand a little bit in that regard. It is $80 to $90 for the water block. depending on where you buy it. Amazon had it for $78.45 at the time of publication. Now it's up to $99. Mm-hmm. So that's worth noting as well.
And we're also putting out
the 90 range.
This is not a sealed or pre-configured water cooling system. You're going to need a pump and a radiator and plumbing and coolant of some kind. So, you know, for $100, you know, $100 will buy you a complete system. For most of the stuff we looked at, a complete liquid cooling system that's ready to go. This is going to be integrated into your existing water cooling system, or you're going to be building a water cooling system from scratch, which means spending a whole bunch more money. Because pumps that are quiet that you're okay to put inside of your PC generally aren't the least expensive things you might put inside of your PC. So.
Correct.
Oh, my goodness. Be quiet. SFXL 600-watt power supply. Lee did this one up, and I was kind of curious. You know, with Be Quiet on the front, are they claiming this is a quieter power supply? Compact and silent energy is a big boast to see on the front of a box.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what the Be Quiet brand was really founded on, right? Was the desire to have lower noise levels. That's still a focus, but they're clearly branching out into just trying to create general purpose things. So this is an SFXL, which is the small form factor, but a little bit longer version of the form factor there. I'm trying to look. So here we go to the noise temperature value. Lee does say that the 600-watt power supply starts out virtually silent, stays very quiet throughout the mid-power range at full load. With an elevated ambient temperature, the cooling fan did speed up and the noise became noticeable, but never really loud. So it is quiet, but it maybe is not. It's not silent, right? So that being said, it performs admirably. It did very well in his energy and efficiency, DC load regulation, and AC ripple test. I think it got a gold award at the end of this. No, silver award, but the only weakness really being that it had a moderately sized 3-year warranty. As I think many of the power supplies now are going 5, 7, 8, 10-year power supplies, all dependent. So, you know, everybody's a little bit different on there, but this is a SFX. So it's meant for chassis that are specifically calling for an SFX or an SFXL power supply. They can be adapted to full size ATX chassis, but you're kind of shoehorning it in at that point. So unless you have a specific need for this, or you get one of these at a discounted price, that seems like a little bit of overkill, because these are more expensive than you might expect. It's $120 for the 600-watt variant and $99 for the 500-watt variant. You're paying for the compactness of the design, right? I mean, if you look at the back there, where all the it's a completely non-attached cable. I don't know why I'm blanking on the term. Modular. There you go. Completely modular power supply. but there's not a whole lot of room for any more connectors on that. So you get a sense of what the SFX design actually does, those types of things. So,
Yep. An option, but not a spectacular one. Silver award from PC Per, which is passing, but not impressive, which is kind of harsh to say out loud, but I think it's fair. G613 or G613 wireless keyboard, G603 wireless mouse. The beginning of a parade of new peripheral devices. I think Logitech's ramping up for the holiday season early by getting a bunch of stuff out, especially for gamers into the stores and the channels. The big thing about this is Logitech's Hero sensor, their high efficiency rating optical. And boy, that just sounds like a bit of a forced acronym there. You know, what they're going for is Logitech G900 performance that was brought by the PMW 3366 sensor, but, quote, offers 10 times the power efficiency, allowing for incredibly long battery life. Everything from the lens design to the pixel surface area to the analog to digital conversion on the controller has been tweaked to improve performance efficiency, which is probably like saying, boy, people love this wireless mouse, but boy, it used to chew through batteries a lot. Some interesting stuff going on there, you know, and I dare say, as expensive as it sounds, as a lifetime Microsoft mouse user, and I don't think I've ever paid more than $20 for one, because I always, you know, I would see a bucket of them for sale for $15 in OEM wrappers and pick up three or four.
this is, you know, this is costing $70. It doesn't look like somebody was copying design cues from bad science fiction and ignoring any or all ergonometrics. Because so many gaming mice now, they look like little spaceships, which is great if you like to hold angular things with pointy edges and easy to break plastic bits. Not my jam, but certainly an option there. But they're claiming 18 months of battery life with gaming usage.
Yep.
That's crazy.
So the mouse is claimed. So it has two modes. It has a high mode and a low mode. So it's high performance mode, I think, which is a 1 millisecond response time, and the low low performance mode, which is 8 millisecond response time. So they're rated at 18 months at the low response time setting, at low performance. Sorry, low performance setting. At the high performance, it's estimating 4 to 6 months. So there's a difference there, and it does run off standard AA batteries. It's not a like USB rechargeable device. I think for the most part, I've been using this for just a couple of days now. I haven't noticed any issues running in the low performance mode, but for people who are hardcore gamers, they're going to run in the high performance mode. I still think 4 to 6 months of battery life off of a pair of AA batteries is actually pretty impressive. And actually, you can run it off just a single AA battery if you want to adjust for weight or whatever. You're just going to get half the rated battery life.
I love the fact that you pointed out. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I love the fact, you know, the thing you point out, right, is with your G900, you typically get 24 to 36 hours of gaming.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, in high mode or the battery sucking down a lot mode for the G603, you're looking at 500 hours of that's like well over an order of magnitude in improvements. That's huge.
Yep. It's pretty impressive. And it also, like, the mouse has other features, like it can be connected to both a Lightspeed device and a Bluetooth device, and you can switch between systems with the button on the bottom of the mouse that way. I think the design, it's not an ambidextrous design. It's definitely one meant for right-handed users, but pretty simplistic, very IntelliMouse-ish by the look and feel of it. And then the other thing they announced was the G13 keyboard, which is a wireless mechanical gaming keyboard. So this is also battery powered. It is rated at 18 months of battery life on two AA batteries. There's no high performance or low performance modes, this particular one. The caveat is they had to got rid of RGB or LED backlight. So there is no LED light on the backlight of these keys. The only lights that exist are your caps lock key, a battery indicator, and the lights under the buttons to let you switch between the wireless and the Bluetooth connection type. Now, it uses Romer G switches, so it's not a Cherry switch. So it's the same thing that's in like the G810 or the G910 keyboards,
right?
Which I've been using for a while. I actually like them.
They're not bad switches. I mean, at this point, there are, you know, there's Cherry, there's two or three sort of third-party alternatives, and then there's a whole bunch of keyboard manufacturers that have decided to make their own switches, and most of the switches are probably made in the same factories as the third-party manufacturers, and seem to be performing really, really well over time. Because between the two of us, I think we've got, you know, I've got hundreds of hours of typing on one of Corsair's keyboards. There's lots of options out there that seem to be holding up as well as the Cherry keyboards. I should point out, I will be reviewing a mechanical switch that claims to be silent next week. I just want to lay that out there.
Interesting. This keyboard also has the ability. So at the top of it, there's a button to switch between a Bluetooth and a the wireless. So if you want to connect this to your PC through Bluetooth, you can do that. Mm-hmm. Although it's not recommended for gaming purposes, just because of the added input latency that drives. What they pitch it for is actually you attach it to your computer through the Lightspeed wireless, you know, technology through the dongle that they include in the box. And then you connect it to Bluetooth to your tablet or your phone, and they actually ship a little plastic dock that your phone stands up in on your desk, right? Or your tablet stands up in on your desk. It's just freestanding. It's not attached to the keyboard or anything like that. And what I've been using it for, and this is what they pitch it as, is you get a text message on your phone, you unlock it, it goes to the thing, you hit a button, and within, you know, less than a second, it has switched over to Bluetooth mode. It's always paired with your phone, and now you can, you know, use your keyboard to type the text message, hit enter, send, hit the button, go immediately back into the Windows environment and start typing it there. And being able to switch between those two devices is pretty neat. It's not, you know, not everybody needs that, but if you've ever, you know, if you're at your desk and you're responding to text messages from your wife or your friends, and then on your computer, you know, you're writing emails, you're doing other stuff, like being able to use a keyboard for both of that is a nice little bonus feature.
Yeah.
But so far, I like the keyboard. I will say that the paint, the labeling on the keys is this may just be a result of the fact that I'm used to seeing semi-translucent labeling because of RGB and LED backlighting, but there's a strong contrast. This is a very bright white paint on the keys, I think in their mind to make up for the lack of backlighting, right? So trying to make it as visible as possible in dimly lit environments if you happen to need that. But
the option is there, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. Full review of that coming up in a couple of weeks, I would imagine, or?
Yeah, hopefully less, but yes, coming up soon.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, if you are looking for more of Mr. Ryan Shrout, the best place to find his work, Alan Malventano, and the rest of the PC Per crew is at, ladies and gentlemen, PCPer.com. I'm Patrick Norton. You can find me at AV Excel. It's the podcast I host with Robert Herron. We talk a lot about home theaters, TVs, and of course, speakers and audio and headphones, because we love that stuff. Home entertainment makes us happy. And you can find me, of course, with Shannon hosting Tech Thing each and every week at techthing.com. We want to thank you for joining us on the adventure that is This Week in Computer Hardware. If you'd like more of our older shows or you're subscribing for the first time, please go to twit.tv/twitch. And you'll get all of the information and copies of all of the older shows. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening or watching, however you consume the show. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.